as we start tonight, the question I want to start with is, can you trust God? Can you trust God?
Yes.
Right, yes. If we were to go around and ask that question, thankfully, I feel pretty confident that most in here would say yes to that. And I'm glad you would say yes, because it's the right answer. But here's what's interesting about the human mind. It's an easy question to answer, yes. In the darkest times of life, in the most difficult times of life, yes, you can trust God. It's an easy answer and it's a correct answer. But how hard is it sometimes to feel that? To feel the peace that should come with that truth? The joy that should come with that. It's easy, at least it is for me, for my mind to have a disconnect. Almost like there's two parts to my mind. Like there's the part that knows concrete truth and knows the reality. Yes, God can be trusted. But my same mind, there's a whole other part of it that's just running crazy sometimes. And it's amazing. It's you step back and you say, wait a second, there's like two parts to my mind here. And it's because our minds are under constant assault, constant attack. The circumstances of life in the sinful world attack us at the foundation of the peace that we should have in the fact that, yes, God can absolutely be trusted. We can say unequivocally, yes, that God can be trusted. And the Bible, time and time again, when it speaks to our trust in God, drives us back to meditating on His Word, so that we can bring our entire mind, our entire soul, under those concrete truths and those realities that no matter how I'm feeling and no matter how the circumstances of life have distorted my thinking, here's the truth of God that I can meditate on, rest in, and have that peace. And the song we just sang, I don't know the song that well, but a line stuck out on the exact point I'm trying to make. When darkness seems to hide His face, I rest on His unchanging grace. When the circumstances of life, the darkness of life, seems to hide God's face, and it's hard for us to see His goodness, and it's hard for us to see the truths of who He is and who we are in Him and our relationship with Him, that is when we rest on His unchanging grace. That is when we go back to our foundation of the truth, the concrete reality of who God is, and let that guide our hearts and our minds. I owe Rocky for helping me with this observation. What's the familiar passage, Philippians 4, 6 to 7. Who knows what that's all about? You don't have to quote it. Just what's it about? Go ahead.
Not being anxious for anything, but trusting God.
Don't be anxious for anything, but trust in God. And Rocky pointed out to me how sometimes we can cause people to have anxiety about the don't be anxious verse. Because like somebody's struggling there and we just pound them with it, right? Like, don't be anxious, don't be anxious, don't be anxious. It's like, I'm trying. It's like, you can put 500 pounds on a bench press for me and it doesn't matter how hard you yell at me, I'm not going to be able to lift it. It's going to crush me, right? So Rocky really helped me out with this passage once because he carried me on, tied it. So that's verses 6 and 7 about not being anxious. And then verse 8 takes us straight to whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute. If there is any excellence and if anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things. So it's not just don't be anxious, because how do you do that? Well, it's put off the anxiety and focus your mind on the truth of God. Colossians 3, 1 and 2, same thing. Focus on the truths of God. Joshua 1, 7 to 9, God's telling Joshua, don't be afraid, be strong, be courageous, and make my word the constant meditation of your life. Psalm 119 is filled with that constant reminder of the importance of God's word in our life. And so as we look at the troubles and the difficulties that we encounter, realize you're not unique in that. One of my favorite verses is 1 Corinthians 10:13, which just reminds me when I'm having problems, I'm not really unique. Everybody around us, around you, everybody is having troubles. And the prescription that God gives us is for us to go back and meditate on the concrete truths about who he is. The fact that no matter the circumstances, no matter how dark life gets, he can be trusted, meditating on his truth. And what's beautiful is he's given us this entire book that shows time and time again his faithfulness to his people in the midst of any circumstance. There's no need so dire, no need so deep that God doesn't meet that need. And he's given us his word here to remind us of that. People often ask why the book of Esther is included in the Bible. And there's a few different reasons. If you want to know more about that, listen to Dusty's introduction from a few weeks ago on the book of Esther. And he did a good job of giving us a number of reasons that it's in the Bible. But one of the key pieces is God demonstrating his power, the infinite wisdom of his sovereignty and his providence in caring for his people. In fact, that's, as we've said time and time again, the theme of Esther is God preserving his people through his providence. And we'll be in Esther chapter 7 tonight, but with a lot of new people here, I'll catch us up quickly. Esther 7 is, as Josh called it a few weeks ago, the pinnacle, or the apex is actually the word he said. The apex, because I remember him saying that, I got intimidated because I'm like, I got to teach that chapter, so I better do a good job, I guess, if it's the apex. But up to chapter 7, we've had different streams of God's providence working in these different avenues with different people and individuals. And here we see them come together. Here's where we see them come together. If you remember back all the way to chapter 3, there develops this conflict between a Jew named Mordecai, who's living in Susa in this kingdom of Persia, and there becomes a conflict between him and one of the king's top officials, Haman. And Haman is angry because Mordecai refuses to pay him the respect, to pay him the homage that he feels that he is due. And so Haman comes up with this plot, and he sells this plot to the king to have all the Jews destroyed, to have all the Jews destroyed. And it turns out that Mordecai's cousin and actually adopted daughter is Queen Esther. She's a Jew, and she is the queen of the king. And so Mordecai goes to her and entreats her to use her position, that God has placed her in this position of influence to be used to save his people, to deliver them from this genocide, this plan that Haman has talked the king into decreeing. And so you'll remember back in chapter 5 that Esther, Queen Esther, has already hosted a banquet that both King Ahasuerus and Haman, this official, they were both attendees. And at this banquet, she requested the presence of Haman and the king at a second banquet to be held the very next evening. And it's the second banquet to be held the very next evening that we're going to see here in chapter 7. When Queen Esther requests this, King Ahasuerus, you see throughout the entire book that Esther has a favor with him. Esther has a position of favor. He loves her as the queen, and he's happy to grant her this request of showing up to a second banquet. Haman, he probably doesn't really have a choice in the matter. He's going to be there. Yet in the 24 hours that takes place between the first banquet in chapter 5 and the second banquet in chapter 7, a few key, critical, monumental things take place. And that's what is recorded for us in chapter 6, which we looked at last week. Chapter 6 begins with King Ahasuerus at home after this first banquet, and he's having a sleepless night. He can't get any rest, and since he can't sleep, to pass the time, he asks for the chronicles, for the records of his kingship to be brought and read to him. And as these are being read through, he's reminded of what Mordecai did for him. Because back in chapter 2, Mordecai became aware of a plot to assassinate the king. He reported it to the king's officials and was able to save the king from this plot. And it was recorded in the Chronicles, but the interesting thing is Mordecai was never really honored for it. He was never really given the recognition that would be due to somebody who saves the king's life. And so as these chronicles are being read again for King Ahasuerus, he not only realizes that, hey, Mordecai did this great thing for me, and he was never properly honored. And so this is where it really starts to get comically ironic. It gets really good. The king decides that Mordecai needs to be publicly honored, and who does he select to head up honoring Mordecai and showing him this honor? Haman, the guy who hates Mordecai more than anybody else, the guy who's behind the plot to kill not just Mordecai, but all of his people. It's a masterful work of irony, and absolutely no credit goes to King Ahasuerus. He is really a clueless pawn in the hand of God here. It's God who's orchestrating these things. Ahasuerus doesn't know that Esther's the adopted child of Mordecai. He doesn't know that Mordecai's the primary target behind Haman's evil plot to kill the Jews, ironically, which Ahasuerus himself approved. He doesn't know that the queen that he loves, his wife Esther, is also a Jew. And so there's a lot of irony in what takes place in, around, and through King Ahasuerus, and he is completely ignorant of most of it. He is simply a tool in the king's hands, or I'm sorry, in God's hands, being used for his purposes. I think that's one of the fascinating things about the book of Esther. It's just how much God is doing throughout this entire book, that where the people in the book have no idea. They're clueless as to the extraordinary things that God is working, that God is bringing about. And so that brings us to Esther chapter 7. Chapter 5 is the first banquet. Chapter 6 is those 24 hours in between where Haman is forced to honor Mordecai. And chapter 7 tells us of the events, the monumental events that take place at the second banquet held by Queen Esther. So let's pick up, we'll actually pick up in the very last verse of chapter 6, because it's in this last verse, verse 14, where we find Haman early in the evening before this second banquet. He's at home having a conversation with his wife and with the people of his household and just telling them about the awful time that he's been having with Mordecai and the awful day he's been having. And so let's pick up where we find the time for his departure to the second banquet arrives. Let's read chapter 6, verse 14, and then just the first verse. Our second banquet. While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hastily brought Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. Now the king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther the queen. So remember, the characters that are involved here, Haman's the one who, back in chapter 3, persuaded King Ahasuerus to issue this decree to have all the Jews killed. Ironically, the king doesn't even realize that he's issued the decree to have his wife, who he loves so much, killed. But here we have them all together in this one scene. And the queen, ever since chapter 4, where Mordecai seeks her out and implores her, like, hey, use your position of influence to save your people. Do something about this situation. Ever since that time in chapter 4, the queen has been very strategic and calculated in her methods. Think about how traumatic of an experience it would be to find out that not just you, but your entire race, your entire ethnicity, the king has decreed annihilation. I can't get my mind around it. Like, I can try to imagine it and try to put myself in Mordecai and Queen Esther's shoes, but it's really beyond what I could fathom. Certainly, if that were to be done, it's a traumatic experience to hear about that. The emotional response, we saw it in chapter 3. Chapter 3 ends with telling us that all of Susa, all of the city, was really kind of in a commotion because this decree was such a big deal. And we saw through chapter 4 the devastated emotional response from Mordecai as he implores Esther to step in and do something. And so it's been something that's obviously had traumatic effects on the people. And how hard is it to respond in a calm, calculated way when you're emotionally impacted? It's hard, right? I mean, that's kind of the thing of emotions. It's like it charges you up and it gets you fired up, and people act irrationally, impulsively. When they're emotionally distraught, our emotions can often cause us to act carelessly and without consideration, but it's absolutely not what we have seen Queen Esther do. Queen Esther, in her response, has been very purposeful and calculated. We saw, first of all, she took 3 days to pray and to fast, and she implored those around her to pray and to fast before going to the king. And even though she knows exactly what her aim is with the king and trying to influence him as it relates to this decree, does she immediately go and just lay it out before the king? No. The first time she shows up, she doesn't say anything about it. She invites him to a banquet. We saw that in chapter 5. And you think, okay, maybe chapter 5, here's where she's really going to just tear open and just lay it all out before the king. But does she do that? No, there's a second banquet. That brings us to chapter 7. And so her response has not been impulsive at all, has not been driven by emotion, but it's been driven by prayer and preparation and careful, intentional acts. But the time has come. The suspense really is over here in chapter 7. This is the turning point of the story. And you've probably heard me say before, turning points in history just fascinate me. Times where all the rest of history seems to pivot on a single moment or hinge on a single moment. And here we have the turning point in chapter 7 at the second banquet, where we see that fulfillment, what Mordecai had said to Esther in Esther 4:14, where he says, "Who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this?" And here we finally have, in verses 2 through 4, Esther's request. Read that with me. Esther's request. "And the king said to Esther, on the second day also, as they drank their wine at the banquet, 'What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be done.' Then Queen Esther replied, 'If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me as my petition, and my people as my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not commensurate with the annoyance, to the king.'" So here it is. The request finally gets laid out. And as I've said, there, time and time again, as you've moved through Esther, you see hints, and you get of the favor that Esther has with the king. And you get that sense again here in verse 2. The king said to Esther on the second day also as they drank their wine at the banquet, "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom, it shall be done." The king loves the queen. The king wants to know what her request is. And he wants her to feel confident in bringing it. He wants, if at all possible, to meet this need. And I'd really like to know what King Ahasuerus expected her to say. Like, can't you just imagine over all these days, he's known her for a while. She's never acted this way before. Like, what's going on in her mind? What is she thinking? It's an age-old quest, like men trying to understand what the wife is thinking. It's an ancient problem. Look at King Ahasuerus. It can't be done. But you got to know, like, he's been thinking, like, what's going on? What is she going to ask? Perhaps she has a family member that she wants a favor for, like, hey, like my cousin Scooter, he's kind of a bum. Do you think you could find something for him to do in the castle and the king? Maybe it's more authority for herself, something for herself. Perhaps it's something material, granite countertops for the harem. I don't know. But you know, he's been wondering ever since she started to act this way, like, what is going on? Oh, and you know, his mind has been trying to guess and like think of possibilities. But as much as his mind had been wondering the past few days, and as much as he had been trying to figure out what could possibly be weighing so heavy on Esther's mind, there's no way he could have been in any way prepared for what actually came from her mouth. There's no doubt that he was totally blindsided by what she actually says. I mean, he's probably expecting her to ask for some favor, to ask him to give some kind of position to a family member or something. But instead, she says in verse 3, "If it pleases the king, let my life be given me as my petition and my people as my request." Try to imagine the scene there, like the look on his face. When those words come out of her mouth, what? Did I just hear you right? Did I just hear you ask me to have your life spared? The life of your people? Certainly, the king must be thinking that there's some kind of misunderstanding here. I'm not hearing her correctly. Because she's just asked me to have her life spared. And to the king's knowledge, there's no threat to her life. I mean, he's the king. She's the queen that he loves. To his knowledge, there's no threat. Otherwise, he would have probably already acted on it. And the life of her people, what's that all about? Because remember, up until this point, he has no idea that she's a Jew. And so this whole thing certainly just wouldn't have made any sense to him at all. The king has no idea that her life, the life of her people, is in danger. And so I'm sure he's thinking initially, there must be misunderstanding here. I must have misheard her. But she goes on in verse 4 to dismiss any ambiguity. She goes on to reemphasize in verse 4, "For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated." Wow. The king, he must just be totally blown away. Can't believe what Esther has just said. Imagine if you were a king. You know, you're one of the most powerful kings in the world, if not the most powerful king in the world. And this is somebody that you love, somebody who is under your authority, coming to you and saying, "Hey, I'm going to be killed." Like, imagine if it was your wife, one of your children. And then worst of all, you later find out it was actually a decree that you were manipulated into to issuing. In the rest of verse 4, she assures the king that this isn't just some petty matter, some trifling matter. She says in verse 4, just to really give him the emphasis on how serious this is, that she's not exaggerating. There's no hyperbole here. She says, hey, if it had been just slavery that we had been sold into, I'd have kept silent about it. I wouldn't have bothered you as the king if it was something just anything less than total annihilation, because that's still pretty serious. That's not to minimize that slavery is a horrible thing, but it falls short of genocide. It falls short of total annihilation. The point that Esther's making here is she comes to the king because the situation is as serious as it can absolutely be. The shock that King Ahasuerus must have here is just hard to fathom. It's not, you think of it on a few fronts, right? Like, first of all, how do you feel when somebody you love, their well-being is threatened? It's awful. It's a terrible feeling. And then how do you feel when you're the king? I mean, this is really a mockery of his authority. For this to happen under his watch, with him to be completely unaware, is a complete embarrassment to his position of authority. We'll see in verse 5 that there's the shock of the king. We really see it come out and how he reacts. And it's in verses 5 through 7 that the truth behind the story gets blown completely wide open. The wool that has been over King Ahasuerus' eyes, that he's been tricked and manipulated by Haman, the wool comes off. And here's where God reveals the treachery of Haman and sets in motion the preservation of his people. Read with me verses 5 through 7. Then King Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, "Who is he and where is he who would presume to do thus?" Esther said, "A foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman." Then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. The king arose in his anger from drinking wine and went into the palace garden, but Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king. Haman is exposed. You sense in verse 5 just the shock that the king is feeling at this moment, that right under his nose is a total mockery of his authority. This plot has taken place. And so in verse 5, King Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, "Who is he and where is he who would presume to do thus?" So he's shocked already. The shock's about to get way worse, right? I mean, who is he and where is he? He's right there, like sitting right next to you. It's as under your nose, King Ahasuerus, as could possibly be. But when trouble strikes, you want to know where it's coming from. And so his mind probably gets to working right now, like, okay, who is this threatening my queen and her people? Is it the Greeks? Because he's had a lot of problem with the Greeks in the past. I bet it's the stinking Greeks that are up to their problems again, right? Or maybe it's some other outside enemy. Because, you know, when you're the king and you're on top, people are always trying to get at you. People are always trying to bring you down. There's always people trying to knock you off of your position authority. What enemy is trying to do this? And in the bitter twist of irony, who do you think? Let's pretend this was the Greeks, or let's pretend it was some outside threat. Who do you think King Ahasuerus would have very likely looked to have something done about this threat? Haman, right? I mean, Haman's kind of his man. Haman's kind of the guy he works with and does all these and gets his things done with. So probably Haman's one of the guys who would have played a key role. And so in King Ahasuerus's mind right now, he's thinking, all right, who is this so I can get Haman together with the other guys and get them after him? And Queen Esther says in verse 6, a foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman. It's a bitter twist of irony. What? It's not the Greeks. It's not some outside threat. It's one of my closest officials, Haman. Haman's behind this. And now you got to imagine at this point, it's a very awkward dinner, right? I mean, it really is. Who's sitting there listening to all this unfold? Haman. I mean, who knows how he's trying to change the subject throughout this whole conversation, right? Like, he's bringing up, what sports did they play back then? Wrestling? I don't know. He's bringing up anything you could possibly imagine, weather, sports. He's trying to change the subject. Imagine being in his situation. He's sitting there thinking, this is not good. Like, this is, like, we've all had that situation. For me, it was always like college test time. If I wasn't adequately prepared, I get like 3 questions into the test and I realize it's not going to work out very well for me. And like you literally feel it in your stomach. Like your stomach just goes like, I'm going to fail. And like you got to think Haman, like he's feeling this right now. His situation is bad. He's had some, like it's been a rough 48 hours for Haman, you know, with the whole having to honor Mordecai thing. But in chapter 7, it just keeps getting worse. And it says that for us at the second half of verse 6. Then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. This guy is trapped. His sin has been exposed, and he's being tangled up in his own web of evil. The king, you really get the impression the king doesn't seem to immediately know how to react. And it's hard to blame him. Again, to put yourself in his shoes here, where your beloved queen has come and told you, hey, there's this decree that you've issued to kill me. And not just me, but all my people. And to have all this unfold and that it's not just anybody that's looking to kill your wife, but it's one of your most trusted officials. Sometimes life catches you this way, where you just don't immediately know how to react. It leaves you speechless. And we don't know exactly if he said anything or not, but we do know, verse 7, that he was obviously enraged at what had been uncovered, and he walks out of the scene. The king arose in his anger from drinking wine and went into the palace garden. This is, I need a fresh breath of air kind of moment, right? He steps out to compose himself and to think. Haman, on the other hand, he doesn't really have anywhere to go. He's kind of stuck in, once again, a very bad situation. And he can look around and just feel his life crumbling down around him. His options are few, and his only hope now is to sit with the queen and beg for his life. Beg for his life. And that's what he does in verse 7. Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king. Now, I don't know exactly how he saw that. Again, there's no words given for us here, but whatever the king's initial reaction was, it was enough for Haman to know, I'm in trouble. I am in big trouble. And Haman was right to be terrified. His treachery and his evil here have been unveiled. Deception has been exposed, and it sets into motion for us 2 different things. One, God's deliverance of his people, but also the downfall of Haman. And that downfall is the focus of these last verses here in chapter 7. Our fourth part, Haman's demise. Verses 8 through 10, Haman's demise. Now, when the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they were drinking wine, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, "Will he even assault the queen with me in the house?" As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs who were before the king, said, Behold, indeed, the gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king. And the king said, hang him on it. So they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. And Haman is dumb. Like, he knows just how to take a bad situation and make it worse. It's a grease fire, right? He throws more water on the grease fire. In chapter or verse 8, Ahasuerus returns to the scene coming from the garden. And who appears, at least from an appearance standpoint, to be making a move on the queen? Haman. Haman. Look at verse 8. It says, now when the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they were drinking wine, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. Really? I mean, really? Speaking from the king's point of view here, one second I'm getting news that you've tricked me into decreeing the death of my wife and her people. And the next second, just moments later, I find you getting in a compromising position with her. Like, who knows what Haman was really trying to do? We have no idea, right? But the bottom line is appearances matter in life. And you never really want to appear like you're trying to make a move on the king's wife. It's a bad look. And especially when the king's already pretty angry at you, right? Considering the current disposition of the king towards Haman, for the king to walk in and find him on the couch with Esther, that's the last straw. He says that much. He says, will he even assault the queen with me in the house? And as the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Here, Haman is arrested as a man condemned to death. And we can't be certain who these other men were. But it really seems as though the king had already decided to have Haman put to death. And when he comes back, he finds Haman on the couch. And just as these words are coming out of the king's mouth, they arrest him. And of course, the question becomes, well, what do we do with Haman? And just like every step throughout this book so far, the king's always got people around him quick to give them ideas on what to do. Like, I don't know if I could handle being a king with people always around me giving me their ideas. A lot of them bad, but this one's okay. As usual, there's somebody with ideas, and one of his servants, a eunuch by the name of Harbona, has an idea in verse 9. And I really like the way he goes about the suggestion to the king. Like, it's almost like he just plants the idea in the king's mind. Like, let's make the king think this is his idea. I'm just going to point out the gallows to him and let the king take it from here. So he just kind of plants the idea on the king's mind. Verse 9, Harbona, one of the eunuchs, said, behold, indeed, the gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king. And the king takes the bait. The second half of verse 9, the king said, hang him on it. The dramatic turn of the tables here culminates in verse 10. So they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. It's a dramatic turn of events. The irony here is extremely obvious. And we see Haman's hatred, Haman's pride, his murderous anger, all this sin and evil in his heart. Who did it end up destroying? Haman. Haman himself. The sinful plans that he made, he laid this web to trap Mordecai. And he laid this trap for his enemy, God's people. And instead, the snare that he laid caught only himself. Sin is always deadly and destructive. We don't always, in fact, we very rarely get an illustration laid out for us as traumatic here as we have in the book of Esther, but the reality is certainly the same. Sin is always deadly and destructive. The challenge for us as we study the book of Esther is that most of us either know the story pretty well or have a general idea of what's coming, right? And so there's a sense in which that robs us a little bit of the dramatic effect. Because let's say you didn't know anything about the book of Esther, that you were completely unaware of how the story would end and how God's providence would all pull together. Well, when you read chapters 1-5, you'd have been kind of confused about God's idea of justice. And like, how is it that the wicked man in the story prospers so much? Because it's Haman, the man who hates God's people, who seems to have everything going his way, who gets lifted to a high place of authority, who's put in a position to influence the king to have this evil decree issued. And so you'd be reading verses 1-5 and see this evil man, Haman, this hater of God's people, and see him being exalted and him prospering. And conversely, you would see God's people on the brink of destruction, and you'd be thinking, where's God? Like, what is God doing? This doesn't make any sense. It reminds me a lot of Psalm 73. Psalm 73, really, the whole psalm talks about the apparent prosperity of the wicked and how so often it seems in our day-to-day life like we can look around and see the evil in this world prosper and the wicked in this world prosper. And then you can, on the flip side, see those people who faithfully walk with God go through so many trials and difficulties. Verse 12 of Psalm 73, behold, these are the wicked. They are always at ease. They have increased in wealth. And so it's easy, I think, a lot of times in life for us to look at circumstances and almost lose sight of the face of God. The darkness seems to really conceal from us what we know to be true about God. Psalm 73, verses 16 to 20. When I pondered to understand this, it was troublesome in my sight. Until I came into the sanctuary of God, then I perceived their end. Surely you set them in slippery places. You cast them down to destruction. How they are destroyed in a moment. They are utterly swept away by sudden terrors. Like a dream when one awakes, O Lord, when aroused, you will despise their form. We saw this with Haman. How quickly did Haman's life come crashing down? It was a little more than 20 minutes. Well, are you talking about the literal hanging or are you talking about, no. We see this time and time again in the world around us. You see the prosperity of the wicked and you think, how does God allow this to happen? But in the end, God's justice always wins the day. God's justice will never be mocked. It will be swift and it will be devastating. Sometimes it does happen in our lifetime, or we see it happen during the lifetime of the person, like Haman. I mean, Haman's life was very obviously came to a tragic end. Sometimes it happens after life. Hebrews 9:27 says that it's appointed for man to die once, and what happens next? Judgment. God's justice will always be served. And here's the thing. You do not want to be the object of God's justice. You do not want to be the object of God's justice, because by nature, the reality is each and every one of us was born like Haman. We might have not been exalted to a place in life where we had the opportunity to influence the decree for the destruction of God's people. We might not always show it in as vivid of a way as Haman, but the reality is we are all born with hearts like Haman that rebel against God, that hate God, and we all await the same destruction as Haman. There's only one shelter from God's justice, and that is Jesus Christ, who took God's just wrath for those who would put their faith in him. For those who would place their faith in him. Haman is a vivid reminder for us to never think that we can escape the justice of God. Haman's story is a vivid reminder that God's justice will not be mocked. Sometimes it happens in this life, like it did with Haman, and there's countless examples of that all throughout history. Sometimes it happens after life, but God's justice will always be fulfilled. For those of us who know the Lord, who have taken the sacrifice of Christ for our forgiveness, don't fret at the work of evildoers. Don't be troubled at their apparent prosperity, at the apparent prosperity of the wicked. God sustains those who are his. God sustains those who are his. And that's the primary emphasis of the book of Esther. God preserves his people. He's providentially at work preserving for his people. These are the truths we have to meditate on. And we always have to remind ourselves that our minds are always under attack in this sinful world, to attack and temptation to not trust God. Because the reality is we all hit dark, troubling periods of life. Either your life right now is in a dark and troubling place where it's difficult to see the goodness of God. And if your life isn't there right now, I can promise you it's coming, because you live in a sinful, fallen world. It's the result that our sin has brought upon us, is that we have trouble in our life. And the only way, the only proper response when it's difficult to feel the goodness of God and see the goodness of God is to go back to the concrete truth from his word, that his goodness is absolutely still there. And his promises are absolutely still there. And you might not feel it. Life doesn't feel good a lot of times. I think of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. He didn't feel good, but he could go back to the truths of God and cling to those promises. And that's what the book of Esther is to us. It's a place where we go to cling to find the peace and the hope that is rightfully ours in Christ as the children of God. Let's pray. Lord, we do thank you for your truths, that you preserve them for us, and you teach us. And I just pray that you would help us cling to these things, that when life tries to pull us away and tries to wash away our hope and our confidence, that we would resolve to stand firm in the truth of who you are, to recognize that ultimately your plans will be fulfilled, your justice will win the day, and we thank you for the provision of Jesus Christ, for the forgiveness that we have in him, that we could be forgiven and be your children. And it's in Christ's name that we pray. Amen.